Our next item is item 15, which is an informational item. So I would like to ask Mr. Robertson to introduce that topic.
Actually, I think what we want to do is
16.
Yeah. Chair Wolf.
I'm looking at the old
agenda.
Right.
The
so
old agenda.
I'm going to suggest that we take item 16 first, the report by State Board Member Moore.
Oh, okay.
And then come back to actually what we'll come back to is the item 14 after Mr. Moore's report.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You bet.
Good morning.
I don't know how that happened.
It's good to see you all. I'm Steve Moore, board member on the State Water Resources Control Board and liaison to the Great Central Coast Region. And always a pleasure to visit you. This time is a little more of a smoky drive down from the Bay Area. And I even had to dodge a grass fire on Highway 101 going through the back roads of Templeton, but I appreciated that little side trip. So, but I made it here and it's great to see you all. I have my usual overview of what's going on in Sacramento, but also might be of interest here at the region and talk about budget issues and then some recent items at the State Water Board and some upcoming items. And then also there's a lot of legislation under consideration right now for the coming legislative session and under consideration for the governor in September too. So I'll touch on a few of those, but as it has been the last few years, it's very active on the subject of water. So in May, when we visited, I did go over the May revise budget highlights, and not much has changed from that. A great deal of those budget proposals have been carried through, but the budget isn't completely finalized yet. Just as a reminder, the state and regional boards, including the Division of Drinking Water, have a $1.3 billion budget and 2,144 positions throughout the state. And within that, there are some areas of growth, in particular in the drinking water division. This pent-up demand within that organization when they were in Department of Public Health. Now they've moved to the State Water Board, they have the ability to more effectively communicate drinking water program needs. And so that's translating into many positions in our drinking water division. As far as the regional boards, there's some augmentation in staff in the area of timber regulation, as well as the SB 445 program for where some gasoline tax is being used to fund positions for orphan sites, something that the regional boards and state board have been pursuing for years, and that was SB 445. And it's been approved 17 positions statewide and $2.4 million. There is still an outstanding trailer bill that the Assembly and Senate have not approved yet. It's AB 1168, and that includes the proposed increase in the regional board member compensation and pooling the 9 regional boards for travel reasons, because certain regions have a lot more travel expenses like this one. And so that's still under consideration. You know, we've been, as Chair Wolf knows, we've been having monthly chairs calls. And this year we've been discussing details of budgets and inviting the EOs to join us as well. This is part of a trend I think is constructive, where the state and regional boards are really collaborating more on what resources we have and what we need to accomplish our goals in the different regions. And so in February we discussed this year's budget and maybe some ideas on budget change proposals that we could work together on for common needs. And we talked about, we kind of coalesced around every regional board has needs in the irrigated lands regulatory program, for instance, also needs to augment enforcement capability. And so we've been really gathering around these concepts. And so I think that's been a good evolution of our relationship between state and regional boards. And we're continuing that this Monday, where we're in the spirit of the legislative session, we're going to discuss legislative concepts that could support regional and state board activities. We'll also talk about the annual Water Quality Coordinating Committee, the WQCC. And this year, we're excited about this evolution, again, with more regional board leadership and participation. We have a draft agenda that where we have board members from all the different regional boards participating on the panel. So instead of having, you know, the Sacramento agencies talking to you about what they're up to, we're actually arranging the agenda to have more of our own staff and board members leading the discussion. And so, you know, we're going to be finalizing that on Monday. And we had a planning committee, and I want to thank Jean-Pierre, Chair Wolf, for being on that committee of five chairs that helped us put the agenda together for this year's WQCC. Some recent items. Last time we were on the verge of updating the urban, in May when I visited with you last, we were on the verge of updating the urban water conservation regulations. And we did so along these lines of having more of a self-certification process for standards of water production reductions relative to 2013. And I'm going to be briefed next week on staff's analysis of what we've received in June. I'd say on the order of 75% of the 411 agencies have certified they have 3 years supply, even if we have a historic drought, thanks to some increased precipitation. But it's not universal. You know, to give you an example out of the air, Turlock, you know where that is, where my fellow board member Didi Diadamo lives, they're actually implementing a 20% reduction, or it may be 16, but there are lots of pockets in the state that still show a deficit of water supply if you assume 3 years of drought going forward. So we're going to learn a lot more about the details of that based on staff's analysis that's upcoming. On June 2nd, we issued the statewide general order for water recycling requirements. And this was, the Division of Drinking Water took this over. It was actually waste discharge requirements for recycled water that we issued, and there were about 30 enrollees around the state. And we turned it into a recycled water order, and it's patterned on an order that was developed in the San Francisco Bay region about 20 years ago. And it recognizes recycled water as a resource and furthers streamlining of the permitting for recycled water, allows a single NOA for a recycled water program implemented in multiple regional board jurisdictions, known as VAC bookability. And so we hope that this is one more barrier removed in terms of enabling Purple Pipe projects to go forward. We're busy with lots of little things just to give you a flavor for what's on our agenda. We had a workshop on drinking water fees, actually. Now that we have a new relationship with the drinking water purveyors, not just in you know, regulating an emergency situation for water reductions, but also in our relationship with our Division of Drinking Water. And so part of migrating that over was to get fiscal sustainability of that program. And we inherited it with indebtedness, or a lack of revenue to support the staff. And so we've been working with stakeholders, with AQUA, to work through the details of a fair and equitable drinking water fee increase. And so we're getting closer. We had a workshop on that last month. And we had a workshop on another new aspect of our operations is adopting MCLs, maximum contaminant levels for drinking water. And we had a workshop on the substance 123 trichloropropane, or 123 TCP, and staff's proposal for a new MCL based on the detection limit of 5 part per trillion. And so they went through the rationale and gave examples of other MCLs that have been adopted. Some have been only adopted in the state level, not the federal. An example is MTBE, the gasoline additive, also perchlorate. There was a workshop in Fresno last night on the same topic. We plan to have an adoption hearing in October. So on July 19th, we had a lively public hearing on the Cal-Am petition to open up the cease and desist order on the Carmel River diversions. And the proposal that Cal-Am and a broad coalition of stakeholders brought to the state board to modify the order to establish enforceable milestones leading ultimately to reduction in diversions, but extending the deadline from the end of this year to 5 years out. And this is very difficult for us to contemplate because, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a fragmentation of responsibility that was frustrating for everyone involved and very frustrating to the State Water Board. We had our staff participate very closely with Cal-Am and the stakeholders. And I can tell you the reason why we were comfortable going forward with our order on July 19th to extend the deadline was because it was a broad coalition. You know, we had the fishery agencies, the Sierra Club, the Planning Conservation League all coming forward and saying, this is okay, because there are these benefits that we're gonna see for the fisheries in the interim, and these milestones of getting certain project deliverables done is a way, and then there are penalties if those milestones aren't met in terms of 1,000 acre feet per year reductions in allowable diversions. And so, but there's also a way to kind of bring it back. If there's 6 month type delays, there can be some clawing back for allowable diversions. So it's an interesting system of incentives. We did not allow carryover. You know, we were lobbied heavily to, if folks, you know, do above and beyond the diversion limits as they did this year. Actually, it was only 7,200 acre feet was diverted during the drought. 3,376 is the allowable diversion, so it was still double or over double its allowable, but there was an ask to be able to credit future years and to create incentive for doing things like forbearance of riparian diversions and enhancement of stream flows. We decided not to grant that. We threw the frame of, rather than look at it as a credit, the thing is, this is an illegal diversion. You know, there's an enforcement order that wasn't met. So under that framework, we said, think of those stream flow augmentation projects not so much as a credit, but as insurance. Because if you don't meet milestones, you'll be able to have some insurance that will allow you to continue diversions as they are. So this was a part of the complexity that we went through. Not everybody got everything they wanted. Sound familiar? So anyway, it's good to share that with you. It was quite an experience. The same day, it was a long day, we had a workshop on what's known as the procedures for dredge and fill permitting. And it's really the 401 permitting program, which is one of our major programs in the state and regional boards, one of the big six. And it's referred to as the wetlands policy. Technically, this would be an amendment to our statewide plans for inland surface waters and enclosed bays and estuaries. But it's to create consistent approaches in our 401 water quality certification program, and with a lot of input from the regional board permitting staff. Based on, there was an audit, you may remember, from 2013 of the whole 401 program, and we've had augmentations of staff in this program as a result of this audit. These procedures are really intended to be lockstep with the Army Corps of Engineers permitting process, but recognizing that there are gaps where a jurisdictional wetland under the Corps federal framework, you can use the same techniques to define and delineate a wetland that may not be in federal jurisdiction, but would be in state jurisdiction as waters of the state. And currently here in Region 3 is one of the regions that's active, has a reputable 401 program, as where I came from in Region 2, the principles of avoid, minimize, and then mitigate for any wetlands fills. And we're trying to bring those principles forward on a statewide level. But it's very controversial. Comments are due on the draft on August 19th. And then we're going to sit down with stakeholders and see if we can work through language to give folks comfort moving forward. Because this is a statewide program. We're doing it now anyway. And we just want to, you know, do our best to make it clear what the procedures are and also do our best in customer service so that people aren't pulled in different directions by the different agencies. We are midstream in the petition process on the East San Joaquin Coalition waste discharge requirements for irrigated lands. And I have some briefings later in August. The item may go before the board in the, I'd say mid-fall, so late September or mid-October type timeframe. So I don't have any real details on that other than it's moving forward. And we received many comments. We had day-long workshops in Sacramento and Fresno, and we're taking all of that very seriously because it may be a precedential type order that can help create clarity if all things work out for the regional board programs. You know, staff here at the regional board was active in the general order for compost operations. We, you know, Taya Tryon was involved in that and other folks. And just want to let folks know that we're doing multi-agency outreach with Cal Recycle, Cal Department of Food and Ag, Air Resources Board, working with the compost industry and other interested stakeholders regarding the land application of compostable materials and the development of performance measures for this general order. And engaging in the California Healthy Soils Initiative. And there was two meetings in June to obtain stakeholder input on the development of our performance measures for the implementation of this compost general order. And you know, this again reinforces our hope that we can serve the regional boards at the state level by creating instruments of general orders. So I mentioned the water recycling order, it's the compost order. These are really the intention behind these efforts is really to make life easier for regional boards, not more difficult. And so when we get into the details on each of these, we welcome input in making these systems more streamlined internally, as well as oriented toward customer service. I think, you know, in the 90s, back when I was a staff member, you know, I took a lot of pride in regional board diversity and different approaches and that sort of thing. But there are certain things that I think we can all agree can be done very similarly throughout the regions, and the state can hopefully provide a service in that regard. You know, a fun little thing that happened in June, the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program, or SWAMP, and our Office of Information Management and Analysis, OIMA, and Greg Gearhart, who leads that up, who is a regional board person and now heads up OIMA. This is our first annual Water Quality Science Symposium at the Cal EPA building. And the purpose of this event was to build stronger connections between the water quality data and information and the decision makers, stakeholders, and other data consumers. And so the talks were focusing on the overarching theme of data integration and analysis across many water quality topics, including biological assessments, toxicity testing, bioaccumulation, constituents of emerging concern, and harmful algal blooms,
which, as you may have noticed, have been in the news a lot lately, and you all have a lot of experience with that here in this region. It's getting the attention of folks above me, you know, in terms of how important and integrative, really, the harmful algae bloom issue is. So it was great. There were over 300 people that attended this water quality science symposium. And so I hope to that we can continue this thing. It's the first of many because this is a great opportunity to share data and do a better job of, as a state of organizing it. So I think I'll shift gears. I'll remind folks that we have the Office of Sustainable Water Solutions, which is really our disadvantaged community financing core at the Division of Financial Assistance. And we have a newsletter that came out this month and has some summary data under Prop 1, how much money has actually moved. And we've got over $6 million for wastewater collection and treatment, and on the order of $30 million that has been moved for small community drinking water projects. Of the drinking water projects, about two-thirds of the funding has gone toward consolidation type activities, something that we've really put a premium on. You know, our division of drinking water has been great because they definitely lead the way in articulating the importance of consolidating these disparate public water supplies for better, more sustainable management. All right. So the Cal Water Fix hearings have begun. That's the Delta, so I won't go into it because this is Region 3. But they are water rights evidentiary hearings, and it's a petition by the Department of Water Resources and the Bureau of Reclamation to change the point of diversion for the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project to a more northerly location. And it's currently, it's three intake points in the area of Cortland, Clarksburg, and Hood. And they would go into two tunnels that would be 40 feet in diameter and 35 miles long and go all the way under the Delta to Tracy. And these projects, it's good to remind folks that 25 million people rely on them and 3 million acres of farmland. So there's a concern by the operators of the projects that there's a vulnerability in the Delta using it as a conveyance. And so this is the old peripheral canal concept that's being brought back. And our role is fairly narrow. You know, is a water rights point of diversion change. So it's a challenge to keep the discussion focused because there's a concern. There's a trust issue, let's just say, for especially for folks that live in the Delta. And we've heard a lot from them already. Board Member Tam Dodek and Board Chair Felicia Marcus are serving as the two hearing officers for these hearings, which are expected to go well into next year. And looking at the calendar, it tends to be two or three days a week. A lot of work. You know, other items coming up this year are the surface water augmentation regulations for recycled water and the indirect potable use thereof. And the regulations are planned to be adopted by the end of the year. And there's a report to the legislature on the feasibility of direct potable reuse, and the which is placing treated wastewater in the drinking water lines. But as we've talked about this in our workshops, it's not really conceivable that we would ever have a wastewater treatment discharge, no matter how pure, go flange to flange into a drinking water distribution system. That's not going to happen. What could happen is highly treated wastewater going into the influent of a drinking water treatment plant. That would be the direct potable reuse type model. So it's very interesting as we get into the details of that. But just the public health protection is the high, the stakes are too high. You know, an operator error, you know, mechanical failure will happen. Just like our drinking water division likes to remind folks, you know, a new capital treatment plant is just like a new car. you know, it works great for a few years, but then eventually you have to start replacing parts. And since the stakes are so high, financing sometimes not as solid as we'd like, it's important to be conservative. So there won't be any flange to flange. All right. Well, covered a lot of issues here, and then there was the legislation. And you may have some questions about specific legislation. As I mentioned, there's 35 bills that we're tracking. Our legislative director is Rob Eagle. You may have met him, and we try to get him to the WQCC. He's going to be talking to the board chair's monthly call this coming Monday about legislative update. AB 1611 is that trailer bill that still hasn't been signed. It includes proposals related to fees for the ELAP program, the Environmental Lab Accreditation Program, that we were trying to get funded, dealing with the drinking water fees, consolidation authority, language cleanup, raising the per diem for regional board members as part of this package, and from 100 to 250, and some technical changes to the temporary water diversion provisions. What are some other ones here? This was an interesting one. AB 2594 from Assemblymember Gordon of Santa Monica. Or no, he's not Santa Monica, Southern California. The bill would specify that a public entity that captures stormwater in accordance with a stormwater resource plan or municipal storms, MS4 permit, would be, before the water reaches a natural channel, they would be entitled to actually use the captured water. This seems sort of straightforward, right? You build a stormwater capture project, you should be able to use the water. But in the water rights world, it's not necessarily as straightforward as it ought to be. And so this would be a cleanup for that purpose, to try to facilitate stormwater capture projects. There is a constitutional amendment that Assemblymember Bloom has put together for making an exception to the 1% limit for a rate imposed by a city, county, or special district. This is ACA 8 that's under consideration. Senator Lois Wolk has been very busy, as usual, on the waterfront. And there's one that she's drafted on housing for water meters for multi-unit residential, so that we can get a better handle on measurement. And also she's got, and that one's SB 7. SB 552 by Senator Wolk would actually authorize the State Water Board to require public water systems that serve disadvantaged communities that consistently fail to provide adequate and affordable source of safe drinking water for them to obtain administrative and managerial services from an administrator selected by the State Water Board. The bill would also clean up and enhance the recently enacted trailer bill language that allows us to order water system consolidation. Senator Wolk has been listening to us as far as these institutional challenges we face in California, but also the importance of measurement of water. She's very much a leader in that. And as is Senator Pavley, who has a bill, SB 995, to update well standards for water wells. Senator Lara from Southern California, SB 1328, another stormwater capture and treatment projects bill, 1328, would authorize the State Water Board to expend monies from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund upon appropriation by the legislature to provide grants to public entities to implement stormwater and dry weather runoff collection and treatment projects because they reduce greenhouse gas emissions by reducing the need for electricity to pump. So we appreciate him making those linkages, and I think our comments, they're kind of confidential, but we said, why stop at stormwater? So these are great ideas, but sometimes we don't want them to be defined too narrowly because they would apply to other things like recycled water. And then I'll end on the note of AB 2480, which is another Assembly Member Bloom proposal that would consider the watersheds as part of the water system, that, as far as asset management. But he's pointing to the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project and the watersheds of Klamath, Shasta, Sacramento, you know, Feather, and which is a sizable amount of the forests in our state, but it's not all of them. And if you think, for instance, the LA Aqueduct on the other side of the Sierras, you could consider that watershed an asset in their water supply as well. This is an important game changer that, you know, I don't really care which front it comes up in. It could be in general accounting standards, but the idea is that you can value, if you can value your watersheds as an asset, it helps you finance things. You know, it gives you bonding capacity, and also it justifies investment of ratepayer funds into watershed management. And New York City is a good example. You know, they were able to save probably billions of dollars by investing in watershed and forest health instead of filtration down in New York City. And they were able to show through an engineering analysis that the watershed investments were more cost effective and sustainable than building the end of pipe. So that's one of those things, another good idea, but doesn't need to be limited to the State Water Project and watersheds. It could apply in any. And that's 2480. So with that, that's my update to you today. Thanks for letting me have a bunch of your time, and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Steve. Always a pleasure to get your report. Couple items I wanted to just ask you some questions on it. The WQCC, so we have a draft agenda right now. I'd like to get a copy, Jean-Pierre, when you have a moment. Is that going to be finalized on Monday?
Yeah, it's sort of semi-final or final draft kind of thing. You know, we can change it, but we certainly want to share it. We just kind of did a last run through this week with the planning committee and checked in with folks, and then we're going to show it to the chairs and EOs on Monday. And yeah, I think at that point it's good to go.
So from the last time we talked about this, there's an item that is going to present the status on chemicals of emerging concern. Is that still on the agenda?
There's a section on the agenda that will touch on that and allow for a lot of discussion, but it's not the title of the agenda item. The title is Water Quality Goals. And so we'll look into some of the mechanisms of how water quality objectives are developed, or otherwise goals that aren't necessarily regulatory objectives, but numeric thresholds that we can put to use. And on constituents of emerging concern, that would be an example.
And is anyone going to be specifically speaking about CECs within this item?
Well, I think, you know, we've left it kind of open-ended, that where the discussion can kind of go that direction, but we haven't. I think it's just a including but not limited to item on water quality goals.
Okay. Is there anyone at the state board that's familiar with the study that was done up in Puget Sound, where they, and this was done by NOAA, by the way, where they sampled wild salmon and then discovered there was 40 to 50 different CEC compounds that were in the flesh of the salmon?
Yes, I'm sure, you know, in our monitoring and assessment programs, folks are aware of those studies, and we have some in our state too. The San Francisco Bay Regional Monitoring Program has done some similar analyses.
It would be great if someone with more knowledge than us is present for that item, so that we could ask questions and get some feedback and information.
Yeah. So I'll take that back to the group. I'm sure John Marshak, who is running the training and the item, would be happy to have answers for you.
Okay, great. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and John actually has done training for state board staff on this matter. So you're having someone, you know, very knowledgeable who will be
good
speaking.
Okay. Then the second item is having to do with urban water conservation standards. And, you know, in reading a lot of the newspaper articles that we get on the listserv that comes out of Sacramento, I've been noticing over the last few months, it seems like there's a lot of communities that are loosening up their water conservation standards. And I'm kind of wondering, what's that all about? I've been reading that there's this tension between the need for revenue that may be at play here, and that's why we're seeing these standards released. So what can you tell us about that?
That's clearly part of the dynamic. When we approved the regulations, I made a statement to that effect before we voted on it, that there's an inherent conflict of interest for many folks, you know, in terms of wanting to sell. If you have a water rate structure that's based on volume of water sold or is too much biased in that direction, then there's a conflict of interest with respect to water conservation. That's not universal in our state. We have a real variety of water rate structures. So many of the water utilities, you know, well, I'd say a good fraction, not a majority, did not have fiscal issues with the drought. But, and some changed their water rate structures, and we actually put that in the conservation orders for some folks that voluntarily wanted us to do that. So that was a good outcome in our minds, you know, in terms of getting water rate structures that become drought resilient. So that's an issue, and that we will be looking at, you know, in terms of what folks propose. But I would take a step back and remind folks that last year's 25% reduction mandate, which is one drop in four, you know, that's a significant cut. Nothing like that's ever been done before. The state has never in its history made any requirement for water production reductions like that. So that was unprecedented, and we had unprecedented conditions. Snowpack was gone, and so folks did rally around it, many not so willingly, but folks rallied around this statewide call. This year, the conditions have changed, and so we thought it would be valuable for folks to put, you know, transparency on their water supplies, and they have to sign under penalty of perjury as far as what water supplies they do have. And so we thought it was appropriate, given, you know, the changing hydrology, to not continue to put, you know, the pressure from the state level down, but continue to have the reporting and the monthly reporting of data, where we will talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, and the media will report on that. And so, you know, the media did characterize it as a relaxation from the state level, but we still have the reporting that we started in 2014, and there's a lot of value in terms of just the public display of that information. And so far the data are good. In May there was 28% reduction in 2016 compared to 2013, so it brought our annual average up to 24.5, which, you know, if you, with significant digits, you can round that up to 25 and call it victory. You know, the state pulled it off in 1 year. But we'll see how June looks like. I think it's so much, you know, the early indications are that it looks good. And that's what we'd be most concerned about, is June, July, and August. And so we want to have the right mix of incentives. The negative incentive was effective, but to a point, you know, and it was sort of uncharted territory. And, you know, we'll see how things go, how the fall goes, if we have no precipitation. All those numbers that we developed, all those mandatory reductions are still in the regulation and can be triggered. So we haven't abandoned it.
Thank you.
mentioned something about the 218. Well, not you didn't mention 218. I'm trying to find it here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the constitutional amendment.
Yeah, ACA 8, I think it was.
Yeah.
And can you repeat what you said and give a little bit more detail? What I heard was if it passed, then jurisdictions would have the ability to raise rates if it was only like 1%. That's what I got.
It was actually an exception to the 1% limit for a rate imposed by a city, county, or special district to service bond, in order to service bonded indebtedness incurred to fund the construction, reconstruction, rehabilitation, and replacement of wastewater treatment facilities and related infrastructure, potable, stormwater, and non-potable, which is recycled water, that is approved by 55% of the voters in the city, county, or special district as applicable. If the proposition meets specified requirements, and it would author the city, county, or special district to levy a 55% vote on ad valorem tax.
Okay, so if I'm a water agency and I want to do capital projects that fall within that list, then I still have to go through the same process as current, but instead of a special tax like 67% passage, I would only need 55%. So there's a 12% reduction to make it easier for my agency to do capital work.
Yes, this is really a local government financing initiative.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Gray?
Thank you, Mr. Moore, for your incisive and thorough summary. I always appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Couple of questions. And this is not strictly your issue, but I think under Chapter 9 of Prop 1, there's all that recycle and desal money, $625 million for reclaimed and $100 million for desal, I think, which is subscribed 100%, it seems like. So what's the state doing to position itself? Obviously, we don't have a bond measure to, you know, get those projects underway, and there's obviously a lot of demand. So is there thought as to future monies?
Yeah, well, good question. It's true. It has, I don't know if it's completely subscribed, but
that's what I,
it may be.
Yeah, that's what I heard from Dan Newton. So
that makes, yeah, because in April it was about 450 of the 625, and there was a very brisk pace of
right,
applications.
And I think whatever's pending is taking up all that funding.
So that's the grant side of it. I know there's some loan component to it. And you might remember we did a 1% financing for recycled water as a drought initiative. We offered $800 million under that really low percentage rate, and we got $963 million, almost a billion, in applications, and we honored all of them. So we're looking for ways, you know, to try to assist with the recycled water, but, I mean, your point's well taken. It's been all subscribed, and so it remains, you know, as we look ahead, we'll have our finance folks look at what additional incentives we can provide for recycled water.
Thank you. And then am I correct in understanding that both the regulations for indirect and direct potable reuse will be done at the end of the year? And how are CECs being dealt with
The direct potable will be a report to the legislature, so it won't be regulations, but it'll talk about the guts of what the regulations would look like. CECs are an issue of great concern to the board, and as part of our recycled water policy, we amended actually that policy in 2013 based on a science panel review of constituents of emerging concern and recommendations specifically for monitoring, especially in groundwater recharge, and I think this will dovetail on surface water augmentation. It was found that landscape irrigation, based on the science review panel, ongoing monitoring is not warranted. But when you're looking at groundwater recharge, there is a proposed list of indicators or of CECs, such as 1,4-estradiol, you know, the pill, triclosan, and there's a few other specific chemicals that are recommended under that. We also continue to fund and invest in
not just chemicals, but the effects. And so we've engaged with SCWRP, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, our science group in the Southern California region, to recommend and develop bioanalytical techniques for certain responses. And so estrogenic responses are the ones that we have the most tools in the toolbox, but we're also looking at other indicators of stress, for instance, glucocorticoid production and things like this, so that we can try to connect constituents of emerging concern with actual effects. Because I think when you talk about things turning up in the salmon in Puget Sound, they're there, they're molecules. Are they of concern? You know, it's an open question, because they tend to be at very low levels and sub-effects levels. That's the story on CECs, mostly non-effect levels. There were examples like flame retardants, which turned up in the bay and the harbor seals, and in the late 90s, those products were banned. The RMP has documented a precipitous decline in polybrominated diphenyl ethers in harbor seal tissue and other indicators in the bay. So it's been a success story of a CEC that's been, now it's not emerging, it's submerged. It's out, and it's a success story. But that was a chemical that would kind of look like a PCB molecularly and had similar bad effects. So that was at effects levels. So that's part of the complexity of this. There's so many pharmaceuticals, consumer products that are out there. Are they at effects levels? So that's what our science panel is engaged on. And they're definitely, that's something we're not turning a blind eye to.
Thank you. So legislative report then at the end of the year. And when do you think the regulations will, is that a 6-month trajectory, a year, you think? Not to put you on the spot.
DPR?
Yeah.
There's really not a schedule for that at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Always a pleasure to see you, and really value the updates that we give. And thank you for being comprehensive. I know sometimes you talk to us about issues that are going on beyond our region, but they certainly do have implications for us all, so the Delta being one of those. So I always appreciate hearing that. I have a couple questions, or not questions, but a couple issues that I wanted to bring to your attention. And one in particular regarding the community of San Gerardo. You were part of the first tour that we did to that community, so you have some familiarity with that situation. You mentioned the woke legislation dealing with affordability for disadvantaged communities. We have a kind of a real-time situation, and I don't know what more we can do, although we are tracking very closely. San Gerardo has found itself in a situation where the county has determined that they no longer wish to operate maintain that water facility, which is the one well, funded by state dollars. And they've taken steps to put that system up for purchase. So they're putting out an RFP on that. We heard about it at the second tour, where Tam Doduck and friends Spivey Weber were with us at that time. And fortunately, they heard the details and were able to alert state water board staff of the situation. So that occurred in March. But coming forward now, what we're finding is the county they don't seem to hold the same level of concern about what will happen if this water transfer occurs. In terms of affordability. So if it goes to a private water purveyor, first of all, does it guarantee that their water supply is protected and sustained for their community? That well was built for them with state funds. And would the water purveyor then be able to distribute that water to other communities? And second, what would happen to the cost of operating that system? And the burden currently has increased water bills from something like $25 a month to $125, something in that range. So they're looking at the potential for not only losing water supply, but affordability. We've been actively following, tracking it, in particular John Robertson and Angela Schroeder, but we are working with state board staff, and they have let the county know nothing can happen without the state board review and approval. So we've got one stopgap in place. But from what I have learned, it seems to me the county is not willingly taking this in, and the affordability issue is becoming, I think, a bigger concern at this point. So I'm hoping that, you know, to bring this to your attention as well, and you can follow up on your end to see what action we can bring forward, as this is, in terms of timing, the RFP is coming out, and the county would like to make a decision by the fall. And the San Gerardo community, and I'll just briefly say, I think they're a model for the situation that disadvantaged communities find themselves in two regards. One, they're facing water shortage, water contamination, but they've also stepped up to the plate and taken responsibility for creating solutions. They've been very proactive and very effective in becoming technically capable of managing their own system. They need assistance with the administration and O&M, but and state board staff is indicating that they're willing to do what they can to support. But I think we need to shine a light on this situation, because the way it's playing out has continued to unfold and demonstrate the unintended, or not unintended, the unexpected complications that occur as a community attempts to get control of its water supply and sustainability of that water supply. So something to, I think, track for a number of reasons, but of course primarily we are concerned for that community. So that's my comment on that. The other is concerns Los Osos. I don't know if you caught the details. It was a public comment that was right at the top of our hearing this morning. And I think the comment made by Mr. Edwards struck me as kind of that coining exactly where Los Osos has found itself. County moved forward with a number of actions, but from the get-go bifurcated wastewater treatment from basin sustainability. Los Osos is in overdraft. It is one of those basins that's been designated as a high priority. And the county has found it very challenging to deal with both those issues. And at this point, the work that has to be done on basin management, basin sustainability, is moving at a snail's pace. And unfortunately, it was grandfathered in. So we're not, that basin will not have any of the SGMA deadlines or criteria applied to it. So I am hoping that Mr. Robertson is going to follow up on that, and perhaps on your end you can follow up on that and find out if the decision to not reduce the interest rate on the $69 million loan for the wastewater treatment plant is a done deal. We understand that if that decision is no longer a discussion, but if there are other ways then to help offset some of the other millions of dollars that this very small community is going to be looking at going forward on basin sustainability, basin management. Maybe there is other assistance that state board staff can look at, because this community is one that is going to be looking at hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're talking about less than 15,000 residents and I believe somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 homes. So it is a community that needs some attention, and I'm hoping you can help with that. Thank you.
Yeah, on the first point, if a private water purveyor took over a system, they would report to the Division of Drinking Water Regulations, you know, so there would be direct oversight from the state board. And there is an initiative under AB 401, Low Income Rate Assistance, or LIRA. there's an ongoing group of folks meeting over that very issue, you know, in terms of severely disadvantaged communities and lifeline type rates that are authorized under that law that was signed by the governor last fall. So hopefully between those two things, San Gerardo doesn't fall through the cracks. And interesting point there about the SGMA exemption of Los Osos, and so I think that's a good question to bring back to our folks that are cutting their teeth on these issues around the state, and what, you know, what remedies we would have in an area that's not covered by SGMA. So I'll look into that.
Mr. Johnson?
My colleagues have already asked my questions. Thank you.
Ms. Cervantes?
Yeah, I just wanted some clarification on your report where you talked about some of the Prop 1 funding and how that's moving, and two-thirds of that going to consolidation. Is that just referring to the money for disadvantaged communities, or that is the entire pool of Prop 1 dollars?
Good question. Actually, it was just money spent to date. And so these are some pies that are on the newsletter, so I was just clumsily describing the numbers. But so far, it's quite a small fraction, though, of the overall, I think, what was it, $260 million or something like that? So, you know, we're only looking at $30 million that's gone out the door so far. But as far as the breakdown of that, about two-thirds has been toward consolidation, which are seven projects total, including three schools. And so it usually involves something like, you know, laying a pipeline that connects to an adjacent public water system. So it can be kind of expensive.
Right.
But yeah, it's a good question. And it's just sort of, it's an empirical description on our newsletter. And these are the DFA, same folks, Division of Financial Assistance, that Office of Sustainable Water Solutions, and so we're trying to make this newsletter easy to read. It's in Spanish and English, and has links in the document that go to funding fairs, and there was one here in San Luis Obispo in May, and there's going to be one in Merced on September 14th, and we're just really trying to demystify, you know, the funding sources for DACs, recognizing folks not sure where to begin, so we're trying to. And these funding fairs are not just the State Water Board, but we work with DWR, Food and Ag, and other state departments to try to cobble together resources for low-income communities.
Mr. Moore, following on that specific example, do you know if rate assistance is coupled into that, like in a consolidation scenario where a disadvantaged community is consolidated into a larger community? Do you know if rate assistance is built into that too?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's probably case by case, but it's a difficult challenge because of Prop 218, cost of service limitations, and that's why AB 401 came on to try to create an avenue for low-income rate assistance. So it continues to be a challenge.
Yeah, and that was related to the other question that I had, because I know that cities and also the governor had been challenged on being able to utilize different rate structures, a tiered rate system, to incentivize increased conservation efforts in the past. And I know that that also impacted the opportunity to allocate some resources towards these lifeline rates for disadvantaged communities. So it looks like they're trying to address it from different avenues to be able to sort of figure it out if we can get around that court decision that prohibited tiered rate structures.
Yeah, and we had a real illuminating workshop on that. It's a complicated issue. About a year ago, about July 8th last year, we had a workshop on that. And what's interesting as you get into the details is San Juan Capistrano was the city that that had their tiered rates overturned. If you get into the details of the case, it's really, they didn't do a good job of showing their work. But what it did have the chilling effect on tiered rate structures, and a cottage industry, you know, of suing cities, you know, over them, and
you know, a bit of an ambulance chaser type situation, if you ask me, because there's not a lot of there. If you do a good job of setting up your transparency of how you arrived at the rate structure, you can be successful. So that's the level, the dynamic. It doesn't make them illegal. It just makes them vulnerable to lawsuit, if you will. But if you do show your work, you should prevail, but then there's still expenses of the lawsuit. So it's very challenging, as you say.
So the showing your work is the public input process that 218 requires, or
that's right, and also purchase? Linking to cost of service to the parcel.
Right. Okay.
That's right. And so it's not easy, you know, and I'm not an expert at it by any means, but it has been done successfully.
Thank you.
So I know Mr. Young has one more question, but I want to circle back on a couple of things. One of them associated with Sonardo. I think we have two issues at hand, very simply stated. First one is the EJA aspect. The second one is the fairness of having taxpayers-funded project, i.e. through grant, and monetize this project for a county. So I think that's the other aspect, which to me would be viewed as precedent-setting by taking public funds and then monetizing those vis-a-vis, you know, a county general fund income. So I think that's inappropriate. So those are the two distinctions I'd like to make on that particular matter. The other one, you were absolutely right, you know, when you're saying that water is energy intense, because the base cost of water, 80% of it is energy cost. You know, as we know, you do not have gravity flow from our reservoirs all the way to a tap. So it has become increasingly evident the tremendous amount of energy it takes to move water around the state. And the last one was on the fire retardant material. Our previous meeting, Mr. Young had asked actually a question about the compounds associated with fire retardant. And so I had followed up on that with one of my multiple meetings that I'm in engaged with, and met with the director of UC Cooperative. And so she forwarded to me a significant amount of information for our staff. And I would like to make sure, circling back, that this information I forwarded to staff gets forwarded to Mr. Young, because it's very comprehensive. I'm not sure if that has been done. I think, Mr. Thomas, you were at the helm at the time when I sent that information, because you acknowledged that. Thank you. But I want to make sure this goes to staff and this goes back to Mr. Young. The example of unintended consequence, you know that compound you talk about in fire retardant? It was found that there was a corrosive effect on the holding water tanks for the helicopters and aircrafts using the fire retardant, you know, that were emulsified with water. So to reduce the corrosive effect, and this is on aluminum tanks, that particular compound was used, and then we found that compound actually had a very significant environmental negative effect. So it's sort of interesting to, you know, trace how some of these things occur, just as a little sidebar. So thank you. And Mr. Young, you had more reflection.
I did want to just circle back on something. So you mentioned Squirt and the work they're doing on behalf of the Water Board, and you mentioned they're looking at biological effects. And so I just wanted to make sure I understood what that means. Those are effects on wildlife. In other words, you got discharges of CECs into the environment, and they're looking at what levels of these compounds have an effect on fish and wildlife. Is that what is meant by that?
Really, and humans.
And humans, okay.
These are assays that are done in the lab, and so they're based on exposing cells to these and testing certain biochemical pathways, you know, in terms of triggering stress response or an estrogenic effect or that sort of thing. And so it's instead of just doing chemical analysis, you're looking at actually measuring the effects.
Okay.
So they're laboratory techniques.
Okay. You know, my concern is with the human effects as well as the biological effects. And I just can't see how it's okay that when we maybe eat a piece of fish, that we're getting an extra dose of Xanax, caffeine, or chloromycin. You know, we have a problem with resistant bacteria and pathogens. It's very real. And eating food that may have a whole bunch of antibiotics in it of different sorts, I can't see as being a good thing. And if we're looking at unintended consequences, Dr. Wolf, this is probably just another one of those that we're going to have to get our hands around and figure out how big is the risk and what do we do about it.
Yes.
So anyway, just my thoughts to share with you and to be continued.
I hear you. Right. It's always a matter of, you know, toxicity is dose. So, and that's where, you know, if you have the chemical analysis and then an effects analysis, you can try to make sense of, okay, are we really talking about levels of concern or not? Or you know, like you say, it's something to keep an eye on. And, you know, I always remind folks that I take a philosophical view that we shouldn't hold back on doing recycled water because of these things. We should develop the infrastructure. It's the wise thing to do. And then we need to, though, have a commitment to look at the Green Chemistry Initiative and things like that. You know, what are the products that we're licensing to be used? And over time, phasing out those that have detrimental effects. Antibiotics, that's a tough one. You know, I mean, that's part of our health and welfare. Is it going through us, you know, and then it gets through the treatment plant, you know, and is it at levels that are we're showing effects? And that's where the biological techniques come in.
And my issue is simply with treatment. I think treatment can take care of these issues if we apply modern treatment standards to the way we handle waste. Mm-hmm. And, you know, secondary treatment standards have been around for decades.
Yeah.
We do have tertiary standards for certain compounds, and I think we need to start looking at tertiary standards for some of these other agents.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
all.
Yep, Israel recycles 85% of their wastewater, and 65% of their food crops in Israel are irrigated by recycled wastewater.
Yeah, how, what percent?
65% or more.
Yeah, and Israel is a net exporter of agricultural products.
Yep.
They're the biggest provider of citrus in Europe.
And they have a research program on constituents of emerging concern in food.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for this always, you know, thought-provoking based on, you know, all the questions from my colleagues and good information. I look forward to being on the phone with you again Monday at 5 o'clock. And I have requested our executive officer to join me on the phone.
Yeah.
So thank you.
That'd be great. Well, thanks as always. It's great questions. Thank you. Good to see you.